Getting ready to focus on the Beatles next week, our tribute show to them. Should we, perhaps, is the question. And for that, and perhaps the answer to it, we're joined on the phone by Elijah Wald, a musician and author. Elijah was on with us to talk about his wonderful book, Dylan Goes Electric. Today, we talk about how the Beatles destroyed rock and roll. Elijah, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
So, well, let's cut to the chase. How did the Beatles destroy rock and roll?
Well, I mean, obviously the Beatles didn't destroy rock and roll, but I called the book that. What I meant by that was simply an analogy to the way people talk about Paul Whiteman and jazz. But the reality is they changed rock and roll forever. And the way people sometimes phrase that is it changed from being rock and roll into what we now call rock. And if that's true, then it ended what came before. And what had come before was dance bands, some of them white, some of them black, but all of them playing roughly the same music. I mean, everybody played Elvis, everybody played Twist and Shout. Basically, the band the Beatles started out being, you know, the band that covered the Shirelles, that covered Chuck Berry. And after the Beatles, that disappeared. You have this division where basically dance music becomes records by black groups and Motown, and rock becomes white guys with guitars that you don't dance to.
Yeah, and it also created a distinction and a separation between those who performed songs they had written and those who did songs that others had created.
Well, not so much. I mean, after all, Chuck Berry was doing all songs he had written long before the Beatles came along, and so was Little Richard, and so was Carl Perkins. I mean, that wasn't new. Some people did, some people didn't. It's true that, I mean, after the Beatles, you know, the economics shifted with the Beatles and with Dylan. I mean, it became obvious that if you were a record company and had a publishing company attached to it, and you got a group that could sell a million LPs, then you could make a hell of a lot more money with a group that sold LPs than with a group that just sold singles. But you know, that's really not so much about rock and roll. I mean, in that sense, the Beatles are the fathers of Simon and Garfunkel as much as they're the fathers of anything else.
And also, they changed radio because I was living in Greater New York at the time and in Connecticut. And, of course, we had Murray the K, and he purported himself to be the fifth Beatle and all that. But when FM really changed and started playing album cuts and longer cuts and more experimental bands, then people started to talk about it as rock. This is rock radio, not rock and roll radio.
Yeah, and there are two things, there are two big shifts that happen there that people often don't talk about. One is that it becomes all white, and the other is that it becomes boy music. I did a show a while ago on another station in New York that had call-in, and about halfway through this woman called in and said, I know exactly what he's talking about. You know, by 1967, all the boys were in one room smoking dope and listening to Sgt. Pepper, and all the girls were in the other room dancing to Motown. That certainly is my high school years. I mean, by my high school years, it has shifted, and the boys were in one room listening to punk rock and Bruce Springsteen, and the girls were in the other room dancing to Soul Train and the Three Degrees. But the shift was real. You know, the split was real and enduring.
And Elijah, there's
a punk rock club and try to find a woman.
there's a fine line, I guess, between sharing your love of a form of music and appropriating that form of music. And the Rolling Stones have faced that criticism through the years, and the Beatles did too. So do you look at it as taking that art form and making it whiter, or by exposing artists like maybe an Arthur Alexander, who was not particularly well known, and letting people hear their music?
Well, I'm willing to bet you that if you get a room full of Beatles fans and ask them who Arthur Alexander is, the majority will say, huh? Chuck Berry, you'll have a somewhat better chance. But, I mean, the Beatles certainly didn't expose the world to Arthur Alexander. They did expose the world to some of his songs. The Stones, to give them their due, actually worked really hard at exposing their fans to black music. I mean, the reason that Stevie Wonder became a crossover star was that the Stones took him on a national tour as right. their opening act. And same's true for Ike and Tina Turner. Same's true for B.B. King. The Stones worked very hard to introduce their audience to black artists, which, you know, love or hate the Beatles, they did not do.
Well, one of the other things I think that changed, too, Elijah, was the way that bands used to, I'm talking about bands, not famous bands, but the local high school band, the local community band, yeah. the band people had, they were playing the hits of the day. And
right.
when
whatever those hits were.
Right. And when the Stones come along, I'll never forget this. I was in prep school and a friend of mine was talking about what great songwriters they were. And a young African-American kid from North Carolina said, well, first of all, that's a Solomon Burke song. And this is a song by that people were playing those songs and thinking of them as Rolling Stone songs or thinking of them as Beatles songs, even when they were playing songs that predated both of those groups. And I think that that's one of the good things that FM radio did was sort of point out, well, this is really a song by whomever.
Your experience may be different from mine. In my experience, FM radio didn't play a lot of Solomon Burke.
No.
Honestly, FM radio comes after the Beatles and the Stones have stopped doing their Solomon Burke and Buddy Holly covers, when they really are, in fact, playing their own song. And, you know, I do understand. I think that the Beatles created, obviously, a magnificent, unique body of work. But the other thing that the Beatles did was they created a body of work even they couldn't play. And that was another huge change. I mean, a band can't play Sgt. Pepper.
Right.
So, you know, once rock and roll becomes Sgt. Pepper, it's a different object. And, I mean, obviously that had happened before. I mean, a rock and roll band can't play That Magic Moment by the Drifters, which also is all string.
Yes. And when that wall of sound, I was thinking about this, when that wall of sound changes from the Spectre kind of pop magic and to something that's far more complex, it seems to me that a lot of people dropped out of that kind of music, and really that has something to do with the great love people have for oldies.
You know, the oldies thing, that's interesting. The oldies thing, if you mean the same thing I mean, which is like, you know, the American Graffiti kind of era.
Right.
That actually happened a little earlier, and the early Beatles hit along with that. I mean, the moment that Oldies but Goodies takes off like crazy is the Twist era, is 62, 63. And that really was the moment when white kids discovered black music.
Yeah, I agree. And I've spent a lot of time in the South, so I was hearing like a lot of the music that you know from not only from research, but because you know more traditional songs than anybody I know.
But you're right. If you were in the South, you were hearing black bands.
Yes. And dancing
Absolutely.
To them. And in the summer, and dancing to them and going to clubs that had all black bands and almost all white audiences, because it was the South at the time. But do you think that in the long run, when we look back on the sort of singer-songwriter era, it will owe more to the roots music that you and I grew up listening to, or will it owe more to the Beatles?
Well, I think the singer-songwriter thing definitely owes more to the Beatles.
Yeah.
You know, and Bob Dylan, and let's underline Simon and Garfunkel, and Leonard Cohen, and Joni Mitchell. But one of the things people forget, and particularly rock fans forget, is the Stones weren't really all that popular. I mean, it's you know, in rock history, people tend to say the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, like those things, were equal objects. But, I mean, when I was writing the book, one of the fascinating things I found was this interview with Paul Simon after he did his first solo album, which is 1971. And there was an interview in Rolling Stone. And he's complaining because he only sold 800,000 copies. And the interviewer, I think it was Jan Wenner, says, but Paul, that's more than any Rolling Stones album has ever sold except Sticky Fingers. And Simon says, well, sure, but forgive my arrogance. I always knew Simon and Garfunkel was bigger than the Rolling Stones. and he's right. Every single Simon and Garfunkel album had sold 3 to 4 million copies, and the Stones had only had one record that broke a million. Simon and Garfunkel sold almost like the Beatles. The Rolling Stones weren't even close. And we've just forgotten that. I mean, that singer-songwriter end of the Beatles was by far the most popular end of the Beatles. It's like, you know, Bob Dylan's first huge selling album was Nashville Skyline.
Right. The least Dylan of all Dylan albums in so many ways.
Right, yeah. But, you know, it was the record that people who didn't like that abrasive stuff could like.
Yeah, right.
Elijah, as a musician and as a historian, why is it that the Beatles' popularity remains so strong today, nearly 50 years after they broke up?
I think there are a few reasons. I mean, one of them is that, you know, you and I are still ruling the airwaves and we're the right age. I think another part of it is that, you know, they really did create an amazingly broad range of work. You know, whatever you like, you can find a Beatles thing that does it. But, you know, I think another part of it is it's not really true. I mean, there are a certain kind of middle class, and I don't mean anything negative in any of the adjectives I'm about to use, but there's a certain kind of middle class white person our age who says, oh, my God, you know, my nieces and nephews, my kids, my grandkids, they're still into the Beatles. The Beatles are completely holding on. But we're describing a teensy segment of society. I mean, if you go into most neighborhoods, kids aren't listening to the Beatles and can't recognize the Beatles. It's a long time ago. And the flip side of that is, do you remember when, you know, the Beatles famously had 5 number ones in a row.
Right.
Do you remember what the record was that broke their winning streak?
Hello, Dolly?
By Louis Armstrong.
Yeah.
So when we talk about how long the Beatles have held on, let's remember that the Beatles' winning streak was broken by somebody from 1925.
Right. Exactly.
You know, Frank Sinatra was holding on just fine in the 1960s.
Yes, he was. Singing with his daughter and holding on.
Well, it's a fascinating conversation.
And Sinatra's holding on now.
Yeah, you're right.
There are as many kids who are into Sinatra as the Beatles, as far as I can tell.
Dylan's singing Sinatra these days, so, you know, I mean, my God.
That's truly strange.
Yes, it is. It's bizarre.
Elijah Wald, the author of How the Beatles Destroyed Rock and Roll. Elijah, great talking with you again. Thanks so much for making time.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.